From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Today, Noam Chomsky speaks out on globalization and human rights violators around the world. Also, Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney pins the blame for genocide in Rwanda on UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, his predecessor, Boutros Boutros-Ghali, and also looks at the United States. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The German industrial giant Daimler-Benz, the maker of Mercedes-Benz luxury cars, is acquiring Chrysler Corporation for more than $38 billion in stock in a deal that reshapes the global automaking industry. The transaction was formally announced today after the boards of both companies approved it and ranks as the biggest industrial merger ever. The new company, Daimler Chrysler, combines the number three U.S. automaker that once trumpeted a Buy American slogan with the German carmaker that had previously held only a small share of the U.S. market. The company said that no plant closures or layoffs were planned, but many labor activists are skeptical of that claim. Cuba has no intention of bowing to demands from New Jersey Governor Christine Todd Whitman that it return former Black Panther Assata Shakur to the United States. Shakur fled to Cuba after escaping from a New Jersey prison in 1979, where she was serving a life sentence. She had been convicted of killing a police officer on the New Jersey Turnpike, but has always maintained her innocence. The Cuban government yesterday issued a statement saying, quote, "She is an academic and a fighter for civil rights. She lives in Cuba like any other person." The statement added that the United States refuses to extradite two, quote, confessed terrorists, Cuban-American exiles Orlando Bosch and Luis Posada, implicated in the 1976 bombing of a Cuban airliner that killed 73 people. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced that Cuba is not that much of a threat to American national security, issuing an intelligence report that ignited controversy on Capitol Hill even before its release. The Pentagon concluded that the collapse of the Soviet bloc had gravely eroded the size and power of Cuba's military, leaving it barely able to support itself, let alone to attack its neighbors. The release of the report was delayed by right-wing Congress members a month ago because they feared it undermined the justification of Washington's hardline policy toward Cuba. The Pentagon made several changes in yesterday's report as a concession to the Congress members. Speaker Newt Gingrich said yesterday the White House was trying to blackmail Israel by pushing it toward the negotiating table, but President Clinton says he was only trying to bring about fruitful talks on Mideast peace. Another Republican congressmember called the administration's diplomacy extortion. The verbal battle, which came just days after Israel celebrated its 50th anniversary, broke out after the United States sought to set a Monday deadline for Israel to agree to withdraw from 13% of the West Bank. Meanwhile, going beyond U.S. policy, Hillary Rodham Clinton told a youth conference on Mideast peace that she supports the eventual creation of an independent Palestinian state. Hillary Rodham Clinton said from Washington that a state was, quote, very important for the Palestinian people and for the broader goal of peace in the Middle East. Her comments to the teenagers went further than the U.S. policy of her husband's administration, which is simply that it is a matter for Israel and Palestinians to work out themselves. The U.S. consulate in Jerusalem, which acts as Washington's diplomatic channel to Yasser Arafat's government, distanced President Clinton's administration from the First Lady's statement. This news from Cape Town, the first of thousands of South Africans who suffered human rights abuses during the apartheid era, were notified yesterday of their eligibility for reparations. 700 people were sent eligibility notices. The commission has received more than 20,000 statements from victims of abuses and is corroborating each one. Each victim will receive about $400, but the amount could be increased if the conditions of the victims or their dependents warrant it. This, according to a Truth Commission official. The Truth Commission is also conducting amnesty hearings for those who committed human rights abuse during apartheid. They're eligible for amnesty if they confess fully and their crimes were politically motivated. This news from Mexico City. Policemen and soldiers are increasingly involved in the disappearance of detainees in Mexico. This according to the human rights organization Amnesty International, which issued a report today. Many victims have disappeared during anti-guerrilla or anti-drug operations, according to the report, which is called Mexico Disappearances, a Black Hole in the Protection of Human Rights. Amnesty, it said, has documented a constant increase in the practice of disappearances by the Mexican security forces over the last 4 years. Meanwhile, Mexican officials tried to stop 135 Italian human rights observers yesterday from trying to visit a village in the southern state of Chiapas State, where soldiers broke up a rebel town council last month. After much loud argument, most of the Italians brushed aside the five immigration officers in their path. And that's some of the news at this hour. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today on Democracy Now!, we bring you one of the most recent talks by Noam Chomsky, the leading dissident intellectual in the United States. Noam Chomsky is a professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. His topic, Market Democracy, Doctrines and Reality. He's speaking at Winona State University.
What I'd like to do is talk about some conflicting visions of the way the world is and the way it ought to be. These are pretty large topics. I'm going to pick up some leading themes. We can pursue lots of others in discussion as you like. There is a conventional view. I'm not going to waste much time on it. You're familiar with it. The conventional view was actually elevated to the level of the Clinton Doctrine by National Security Advisor Anthony Lake, who's the intellectual of the administration. He said that throughout the Cold War, the United States contained the global threat to market democracies, and now we can move on to consolidate the victory of democracy and open markets. And having taken up this challenge, now quoting distinguished commentators from the New York Times, having picked up the challenge, American foreign policy has entered a noble phase with a saintly glow. There is a dissenting view, you know, we have a lively free press. The dissenting view is that of critics who warn that by granting idealism a near exclusive hold on our foreign policy, we may be neglecting our own interests in the service of others, and that may not be wise. There's also an analog with regard to the domestic scene. It was nicely expressed in a lead article in the New York Times last Sunday's New York Times. Headline read, America is prosperous and smug. Story went on to explain that Americans have boundless confidence, expectations of unlimited economic success. They're basking in the happy glow of an American boom, a fairy tale U.S. expansion since 1991 under the direction of the saintly Alan Greenspan. The last phrase is courtesy of the London Financial Times, a very staid, serious journal. Rest is New York Times. Well, let's have a look. Begin with the happy glow of the American boom and the fairy tale expansion. It certainly has been a happy time and a fairy tale for some. The story that I quoted in the New York Times actually gives one example to illustrate the happy times, the one you would guess, the stock market. There's been enormous asset inflation in the last couple of years, and that is certainly a benefit to the 1% of the population that owns, of the households that own about half the stock, and the 10% that own about 90% of the rest. If you add pension plans into this, you get a little bit of redistribution in the top 1/5 of the population, and that's about it. So for them, it's been a fairy tale, although the business press expects a collapse. Read the Economist lead story this week, because it is an asset inflation. The business press has also been quite ecstatic. about profit growth, which is last couple of years, it's been described as extraordinary, dazzling, stupendous, kind of run out of adjectives. They do recognize some problems. Business Week had an article with the headline, "The Problem Now, What to Do with All That Cash as Surging Profits Are Overflowing the Coffers of Corporate America." A little later, got even worse. They reported that liquid assets of non-financial corporations reached a staggering $680 billion, causing vexing problems for Boeing, Intel, and General Motors, and others like them. So, you know, there are some problems in prosperous America. Fortunately, there's a solution to the problems. Cut capital gains, taxes on capital gains. That's bipartisan consensus, and that's supposed to be for the benefit of everyone, not just for the top 1% of families for which it's half of their income. The reason it's going to be a benefit for everyone is, if you've studied economics or read the business press, you know, is because that's going to free funds for investment, and that's good for all of us. The problem is that staggering two-thirds of $1 trillion that's causing such vexing problems somehow isn't enough, so we have to add some more. Well, it takes a kind of good education to assimilate and deal with all of this with proper sobriety, but I hope you're up to it. How can we have dazzling profit growth when the fairy tale expansion is the worst one, the weakest one since World War II? Well, there's an answer to that also. For two-thirds of the population, wages and incomes have either stagnated or declined. In fact, for two-thirds of the population, wages are now below what they were in 1979, considerably below. In the latter part of the 1980s, which was a period of recovery from the deep recession of the early 80s, in the latter part of the 1980s, hunger in the United States went up 50% to about 30 million people. If you look back around 1980, the United States was more or less among the other industrial societies by such measures as poverty, child malnutrition, infant mortality, child mortality, proportion of the population in jail, inequality, other measures of what's called quality of life. Now it's far ahead of all other industrial societies. It's left them all way behind by these measures. Actually ranks near third world countries in some respects. Working hours are way up since 1980. Wages are down. Support systems and working conditions have declined. They're the worst in the industrial world. The level of accidents on the job has gone way up, doubled in the 1980s. Illegal firing of union organizers tripled in the 1980s, along with a whole lot of other violation of labor laws. The reason for that was pretty straightforward. The Reagan administration and now the Clinton administration have essentially informed the business world that they're not going to apply the law, period. You can read about it in the business press, which is rather happy about it. They think they may be going too far. These are big factors in the rising inequality, the attack on wages, incomes, support systems, and so on. If you look at the New York Times business pages instead of the upbeat stories on the front page, they describe what they call a treadmill economy in which most people are going nowhere fast. So how can it be such a wonderful place for Americans who are so smug and prosperous? Well, that's easy. All you have to do is understand that the word Americans doesn't refer to Americans. What the word Americans refers to is the folks who, people who write in the New York Times, have dinner with in elegant restaurants and meet in executive suites and editorial boards. And for them, which is a sector of the population, no doubt, they're smug and prosperous and fairy tale and so on and so forth. If something like two-thirds or three-quarters of the population is left out of this, well, they're just not Americans. So it all kind of makes sense once you understand how to read it properly. Let's turn to the saintly Alan Greenspan, who presided over the miracle in the 1990s. He has interesting things to say. For example, in his testimony to the Senate Banking Committee about a year ago, he discussed the miracle, took great pride in it. He attributed the miracle to what he called, these are his words, greater worker insecurity, which is an obviously good thing in a decent society. Again, if you've studied economics, you know that greater worker insecurity contributes to something that's called the health of the economy. Health of the economy is a technical notion, kind of ideological notion to be, let's call it technical, we don't want to be unfair. It's a technical notion, it's uncorrelated with the welfare of the population, even with the health of the population, but it means something. It has to do with macroeconomic statistics and so on. And greater worker insecurity does contribute to this nice thing, health of the economy. The idea is that workers are intimidated and therefore they're afraid to ask for living wages or for benefits. And that's a good thing. That makes Americans smug and prosperous, at least the ones who count as Americans. The last 1997 economic report of the president, Clinton administration, also took great pride in the fairy tale economic boom, and they attributed it to what they called significant wage restraint, which results from changes in labor market institutions and practices. Like, for example, not enforcing the laws on illegal strike breaking and not enforcing OSHA regulations, Office of Safety and Health regulations. It's what accounts for the huge rise in accidents and so on. Or allowing what are called permanent replacement workers to break strikes. The United States is the only industrial country that allows this. There used to be two. The other one used to be South Africa, but had some unfortunate changes there. The United States has been, in fact, censured by the International Labor Organization for this practice, but the big guys don't pay any attention to things like that. Other factors in the fairy tale are illustrated rather well by the Caterpillar strike, which just ended. Caterpillar won a big victory after a long strike, making use of permanent replacement workers. It's a good way to break strikes. That's why it's considered illegal in most of the world. They also use the dazzling profits that they share with other people who qualify as Americans. They used it not for economic growth, but they used it in a way which impedes economic growth, namely by constructing excess capacity abroad. But there's a good point in that may not contribute to economic growth, but it does contribute to class warfare. So when you have excess capacity abroad, and if your workers at home try to organize, you can take care of that very easily by just producing abroad. And we get cheap, repressed workers and brutal societies that are part of our achievement in their saintly glow of our noble foreign phase of our foreign policy keeps things that way. And that's a terrific weapon against workers at home. So that's also contributed to the economic miracle. Capital is mobile, labor is fixed. Happens to be in contradiction to free trade doctrine, but nobody pays much attention to that. And international labor links are still very weak. They're barely beginning to exist, but not enough to deal with the mobility and power of highly integrated, concentrated capital, which is backed by very powerful states like ours, and also by secret bureaucracies like the International Monetary Fund. And in that highly unequal contest, Americans can bask in the happy glow of the fairy tale economy.
MIT Professor Noam Chomsky. We're going to come back to the speech that he gave at Winona State University just a few weeks ago in just a minute here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. As the corporate media continues to report the good news about the economy, we continue to bring you Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at Massachusetts Institute of Technology and leading political analyst in this country, speaking at Winona State University.
Well, other factors in this great achievement are the trade agreements. Come back to those. But they've had an interesting and predictable effect. So take, say, NAFTA. Under popular pressure, the government was forced to put in some meaningless wording in the NAFTA treaty about labor rights and that sort of thing. It's an investor rights agreement, but they had to put in some nice words about labor and the environment just to keep people quiet. They don't have any teeth, contrary to the others, but they're there. And out of that, some interesting things happen occasionally. So some telecommunication workers did bring a case under the NAFTA rules against Sprint Corporation for illegal labor practices. It sort of worked its way through the various procedures. Finally, the NLRB, National Labor Relations Board, ruled in favor of them after several years and gave Sprint a little tap on the wrist. But one thing that happened is that under the NAFTA rules, it was necessary to undertake a research study of the effect of the threat of transfer of production on labor organizing. And the study was done. It was done by Kate Bronfenbrenner, who's a labor historian at Cornell University. It was suppressed by the Clinton administration, but Canada and Mexico released it. The study revealed that since NAFTA, half of organizing activities in the United States have been disrupted by threats to transfer production. So that means, you know, trailer outside the plant saying Mexico transfer job and things like that. These threats are not idle. They're very real. When organizing nevertheless succeeds, its actual closures are at triple the pre-NAFTA rate. And as you'd expect, they are in the threats are in the more mobile industries. So they're in manufacturing, not construction, for example. All of that's illegal again, but that's a technicality. As I mentioned, the Reagan and later the Clinton administration have informed the business world that crime will pay, so with state protection, so it doesn't matter whether it's illegal. Well, all of these things are among the changes in labor market institutions and practices that have helped contribute to the happy glow of smug and prosperous Americans. The saintly Allen also recently gave a talk to newspaper editors. This was interesting. He talked quite passionately about the miracles of the market and the wonders that have been brought about by consumer choice and how that's proven to be the wave of the future. And he gave some examples, and they're interesting to look at. The examples that he gave are the internet, computers, information processing, satellites, and transistors. Those are achievements of the miracles of the market thanks to consumer choice. And I wasn't at the meeting, but I presume the newspaper editors all cheered. Anybody who has even a minimal acquaintance with the American economy would have cringed. I mean, these are classical examples of state production. Take, say, the internet. It was developed in the state system, in the Pentagon primarily, for about 30 years. All the ideas, all the technology, you know, the software, the hardware, every innovation, all straight in the state system. And finally, a couple of years ago, handed over to people like Bill Gates, who was so uninterested in it that as late as 1994, he wouldn't even go to conferences about it. Of course, now, if you can use it for, you know, making money, that's fine, after the public paid for it for 30 years. The role of consumer choice was zero. What about computers, basis of the modern economy? Well, 1950s, computers were big, clunky things. I kind of remember them around MIT. They were unmarketable. Vacuum tubes were always blowing up and that sort of thing. So the public paid for 100% of computer development. By the time that it got to the point where you could market them, you started getting spin-offs. And so people who were, this was all under the cover of air defense. Whether anyone took that seriously or not, I have no idea. It was at an MIT lab. I suspect not, but anyway. As soon as it got to be, you know, things, as the hard problems were worked out, you got spin-offs. People who had been running these programs set up companies. That's Route 128, you know, the highway around Boston, all full of, technology. This is the big center of technology at that time, and still, all spin-offs from military industry done through the universities, which are often a major funnel for this. The reason IBM is producing computers, not typewriters, is largely for the same reasons. By the 1960s, they were marketable, so the public share went down to about 50%. By the 1980s, there were all sorts of new developments coming along, you know, massively parallel processing. The Japanese were threatening fifth-generation computers and so on. So the Reagan administration, who are radical statist interventionists, the most anti-market administration in modern history, they sharply increased the public input into computer development. I'll come back to that. That's the story of computers. I won't run through. Information processing came out, almost all of it, out of the same Pentagon office, the information processing office of DARPA and the Pentagon. Satellites, we don't have to discuss. You've heard of the space program and rocketry. And the trend, the one case that he mentioned where you might say something about private industry is transistors. They were, in fact, developed in a private laboratory, Bell Laboratories, the laboratory of AT&T. So maybe that's an example of the miracles of the market and consumer choice. Well, there's a couple of problems with that, too. AT&T was a monopoly, so there was a state-backed monopoly, so there was no consumer choice. Being a monopoly, they were able to charge monopoly prices, which meant that they could have a big laboratory, Bell Labs, real good laboratory. Used to go there when it still existed. And all sorts of things happened there, like developing transistors and information theory and solar cells and radio astronomy and so on, but taxing the public through monopoly pricing. So that's just a counterpart to Pentagon funding. And incidentally, as soon as the monopoly status disappeared, so did Bell Labs. The industrial labs disappeared as soon as the public wasn't paying for them anymore. In fact, now there's some descendants, but they deal with, you know, very applied research that has to have a payoff in a year and that sort of thing. Furthermore, though the transistor was developed at the monopoly laboratory, it was using technology and ideas that were developed during the war, like ways of purifying silicon chips and things like that. So feeding off publicly funded technology. Furthermore, after the transistors were in fact invented in 1947, nobody had anything to do with them. It was through government procurement that AT&T and Western Electric, its producer, developed the technology and the management techniques and the improvements and so on, which finally made them available. Government procurement was taking just about 100% of the transistors that were produced and, in fact, directed the way in which they developed. As late as 1958, 10 years after they were invented, Western Electric was producing plenty of hundreds of thousands of transistors, and 100% of them were going to the government. Not zero were going into the Bell system. Well, that's how transistors were developed, thanks to the miracles of the market. These are his examples, not my examples. Every single one of the examples is like a textbook case of how the public funds and private power gets the rewards. So the costs and the risks are socialized, public pays for them, and the profit and the power are privatized. That's what we call private enterprise and the miracles of the market. No wonder Americans are so smug and prosperous, the right Americans. There's nothing very secret about this. In fact, even the most ignorant economist has got to be aware of all of this. Just virtually every dynamic sector of the U.S. economy works this way, often under the cover of defense, but pretty much the same is true of things like pharmaceuticals. So about half the R&D, research and development, for the pharmaceutical industry comes straight out of the public purse. Furthermore, the trade agreements are designed, they're highly protectionist agreements, and one reason for the extraordinary level of protectionism built up, built into them, is to ensure that, say, Merck Pharmaceutical and so on, will have, in effect, monopolies, long-standing monopolies, maybe up to 40 years, for the publicly funded research and development that they now control. All of this undermines economic growth, but it does increase power and profit. Also shoots drug prices up through the roof and, you know, reasons why people can't get drugs at their HMOs, but it makes Americans smug and prosperous. Well, that's the way the economy works. Naturally, business is delighted. You can give speeches about, you know, the miracles of the market if you like, and maybe people will even believe them, but not anybody who's opened their eyes or who's even looked at what goes on in the American economy. And others are very similar. There's none that aren't. The only economies around that do keep to market discipline are the poor ones, and that's because they have it rammed down their throat. Incidentally, the same is true inside the United States. So market discipline is just fine for, you know, 7-year-old children of mothers who can't get jobs. For them, you know, they have to learn the work ethic and how to, you know, break the cycle of dependency and so on, but not the people who are feeding off the public at the public trough. I mean, they have to keep in their cycle of dependency so Americans can be smug and prosperous. When you look at particular cases, it becomes almost a joke. So take the leader of the conservative revolution in Congress, in the House, Newt Gingrich. He's very high on the work ethic and the cycle of dependency and all that stuff for poor people abroad and poor people at home. On the other hand, year after year, he holds the championship for bringing federal subsidies to his rich constituents in Cobb County, Georgia, where the biggest employer is Lockheed Martin, known as, it's called private enterprise. It's, you know, it's about as private as the Pentagon is, except that the profits are privatized and the power, but everything else comes out of the public purse. There's an current estimates are that the average household in the United States pays about a $200 a year Lockheed Martin tax. Partly to keep people in Cobb County on their cycle of dependency. Even with all the public support, Lockheed, like many other transnationals, has taken nosedives. And when it does, you step in again. So in 1971, Lockheed was going bankrupt, and the Nixon administration handed it $250 million in loan guarantees. It was that act that led Senator Proxmire to coin the term corporate welfare, but the term's a little misleading because the whole game is corporate welfare, including the core of the industrial system, like the examples that Greenspan picked as proofs of the miracle of the market. Let's move over to the Senate. The Senate Majority Leader, Trent Lott, well, I'll read a headline from the Financial Times. Remember, this is a very conservative business journal. The headline says, "Most Successful Pork Producer of 1997. And then the article's about Trent Lott. He's leading the conservative revolution in the other chamber of Congress. I'll just give one last example to illustrate the real world as distinct from the world of doctrinal fantasy. And remember, the doctrinal fantasy is used as a weapon. It's used as a weapon against poor and defenseless people here and elsewhere. Here, a large, considerable majority of the population. In poor countries, you know, it's like a disaster. So here's the way it works. I'll take it again from the New York Times. This is just a couple of days ago, front page story, April 16th. It's about Idaho. Which is having an amazing economic miracle. It's the article's about Idaho's prosperous new economy. And the article points out that it's not all so wonderful. It has some of the problems of, you know, free market development. Idaho's prospering, but it's also breaking national records in child abuse and child neglect, in imprisonment. Unions are wiped out. Reading scores are going way down. It's the worst state in the country to be poor, according to a national study that they show, but that's just the downside. The good part is that there is a prosperous new, I'm quoting, a prosperous new economy in the nation's most Republican state, with its deep-seated distrust of the federal government and its tradition of self-reliance. Well, from the article, we don't learn anything about the economic miracle, so we have to look elsewhere, and fortunately, it's a free country, so you can look elsewhere. For example, you can look at the publications of the Idaho National Engineering and Environmental Laboratory. I'll quote from its September 1997 issue. This is a national laboratory managed by the Department of Energy and Lockheed Martin. That's the private contribution. Lockheed Martin, DOE, is the public contribution. It opens by saying, Americans, it's kind of a puff piece for the lab, so, you know, it starts, Americans have made a huge investment in the Idaho National Laboratory since it was founded in 1949 to bring us nuclear energy and a nuclear navy. Last year, the DOE put $850 million into this one site in Idaho, which is the premier, I'm quoting it, premier engineering lab in the DOE system of national laboratories. Here's its mission. Its mission is to move federally developed technology into private industry and academia. Academia is a joke. Academia is just the funnel, one of the funnels by which public funds get put in private pockets. So I get my salary, I shouldn't dump on it too much. So the mission of the laboratory is to take federally funded technology, federally funded, you know, it doesn't mean from Mars, it means out of your pocket. So take technology that you fund and put it into private industry, into private industry. That's the way the economy works in a free market. And that's what this lab is for. It's not only nuclear energy, it's also, I'll quote from the report, radioactive waste disposal, chemical processing, the world's most sophisticated materials testing complex, a lab that's working on what they call rapid tooling technology that should revolutionize the way automobiles and other products are built after the taxpayer gifts are handed over to the private sector in the usual fashion, has a supercomputer center to make sure that the United States stays at the advanced edge of way ahead in advanced computer design. Incidentally, the Clinton administration just gave a little nudge to that as well. It raised the tariffs a couple of months ago very high on supercomputers to keep out Japanese supercomputers, which are apparently better. They've been kept out of the U.S. market so far by Buy American programs. Supercomputers are used almost entirely in national institutions, and they only buy American. But now others want to get into the act, and they want to buy Japanese supercomputers, and that would undermine Cray Research, which is what's called private enterprise, meaning its technology and its funding come from the public, and its market is the public, but again, profits and power are privatized, and since it isn't competitive, we have to raise tariffs on Japanese supercomputers to keep them out of the market. The Clinton administration has, which is nowhere near the Reaganites yet in its protectionist moves, has instituted tariffs on things ranging from supercomputers to Mexican tomatoes. In the case of Mexican tomatoes, it's because of consumer choice. Consumers preferred them, they were cheaper, and it was undercutting Florida agribusiness, so therefore, in violation of NAFTA rules and World Trade Organization rules, the Clinton administration just slammed high tariffs on them. Remember, the big guys do as they like. The laws are for poor people. You know, that's kind of as old as history. Another one of those things you're not supposed to know if you've had a good education.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky, professor of linguistics at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, America's leading dissident. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, I'm Amy Goodman. UN Secretary General Kofi Annan told Rwanda's parliament today the world failed the African nation in 1994 by not mustering the political will to halt genocidal killings that took hundreds of thousands of lives. But here at home, a New Yorker piece says it was Kofi Annan himself who ignored the signs for the genocide to come. We first go to Pacifica's Don Rush in Washington, who attended a House hearing this week on the accusations.
Top UN officials fended off charges that they had been warned of the 1994 Rwanda genocide by their top military man in the country, but refused to act. The New Yorker magazine has reported that just months before the onset of the genocide, General Romeo Dallaire sent a telex to UN headquarters warning of the impending disaster. But the UN top political man in Rwanda apparently disagreed, and the world body never acted. Today, UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, who headed up the UN's peacekeeping headquarters at the time, dismissed the report, calling it an old story. During a stopover at the Rwandan genocide trials in Tanzania, Annan blamed the international community for lacking the will to act in 1994. Here in Washington, Shahryar Khan, formerly with the UN's operations for Rwanda, defended the UN's conduct before a House panel.
And the Dallaire telegram was, Mr. Chairman, the only telegram in a mass of telegrams that were going from Kigali to New York. It was the only telegram which suggested genocide. All the telegrams that I saw suggested a descent towards civil war, a descent towards rearming and military confrontation of high ethnic tension, and certainly a civil war was imminent. But this was the one telegram that indicated that something worse was afoot.
But Alain Destesh, a member of the Belgian parliament, countered that the Dallaire telegram was not the only document pointing to genocide. And he added the importance of the Dallaire telegram cannot be overemphasized.
Now, this cable is crucial, and its importance cannot be underestimated. I would like to ask to that committee and also to the UN Secretary General, how many times since 1945 did the UN in New York receive a fax from his force commander in the country, warning of the likely possibility of an extermination?
The Belgians have completed their own investigation of their country's failure to act to prevent the 1994 genocide. The French government is currently carrying out a probe of its failure in Rwanda, but the UN has refused to allow Dallaire to testify in these investigations. And House Republican Christopher Smith told the UN official that he smelled a cover-up.
To deny an important witness to your investigative body or to this subcommittee or any other parliamentary body, and then invoking immunity, namely for General Dallaire, denying an important document, the facts or other documents, would you or any of you suggest that that might be suggesting of a cover-up? This isn't the Manhattan Project. We're talking about a genocide. We want to know what happened, who knew what, when, and if judgments were made, we need to know so they're not replicated.
That piece reported by Pacifica's Don Rush. We now turn to the first African-American woman ever elected from Georgia, Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney. Can you tell us about the hearing you attended this week?
On Tuesday, that hearing was before the Human Rights Subcommittee of the House International Relations Committee. And at that hearing, we had the Secretary General of the United Nations Special Representative in Rwanda at the time in 1994, Ambassador Shahryar Khan from Pakistan. We also had Senator Alain Destex from Belgium, who was the instigator of the Belgian inquiry into the decision-making that led to the removal of Belgian troops and of UNAMIR, which was the United Nations operation in Rwanda in the heat, literally, of the genocide that began in April of 1994. What we did not have at the hearing was our own State Department. So we had Ambassador Khan, who came all the way from Pakistan to appear before this hearing. We had Senator Destex come all the way from Belgium to appear at this hearing, and our own State Department couldn't come across town to appear before this hearing. And because of the no-show of the United States government, then there was an upbeat in the call for an investigation of the type that Belgium conducted and that is currently being conducted in France. Now, what we do know is that there were three governments that were made privy to the information about the impending genocide. That was France, Belgium, and the United States. We also know, as well as the United Nations. We know that the United Nations did nothing. We know that those three governments did nothing. Those governments, two of those governments, have had or either are undergoing their own internal scrutiny. What has not occurred is that the United States and the United Nations undergo the same kind of critical self-examination. I would not just blame Kofi Annan for the refusal of United Nations intervention at that time to prevent the genocide. I would want to know, what did the Secretary General of the United States know, and when did he know it? And at that time, we're talking about Boutros Boutros-Ghali. Because Boutros Boutros-Ghali was the Secretary General of the United Nations at the time that the fax was sent up and that the Rwanda genocide occurred. Therefore, we know, well, we suspect that Kofi Annan wouldn't make such a grave decision in isolation. We also know that Boutros Boutros-Ghali was involved with the extremist Rwandan government at the time. So the question cannot end or begin with Kofi Annan. The question must end and begin with everybody who was a part of the United Nations Secretariat, and that includes the top person, and that is Boutros Boutros-Ghali.
But at the time, Kofi Annan was the man in charge of the peacekeeping force that was there, right?
He was the director of the peacekeeping operations, and to that extent, he is a part of the problem, but he is not the entire problem, and we want to make that clear.
Now, we first heard questions being raised about Kofi Annan, and this was sort of rumor for a little while before this fax surfaced of a warning to the top officials at the UN that a genocide was about to take place, that mass murders were about to take place in this fax that was sent to New York. But we've started first hearing about these rumors about Kofi Annan right around the time he negotiated that agreement with Saddam Hussein. And at the time, we thought this was an attempt by the right wing to discredit the UN Secretary General, Kofi Annan.
That's why I don't want to be a part of anything that discredits unnecessarily a good person. We understand that mistakes were made, and I want to make it perfectly clear that Kofi Annan isn't the only one who made a mistake. The President of the United States had three letters that were sent to him by the Congressional Black Caucus and Congressman Donald Payne. Other members of Congress were speaking out at the time in 1994. Those three letters went unresponded to and have not been responded to this date. We also know that there was an active campaign to prevent in the United States at the highest levels to prevent the use of the word genocide, because once it became labeled and known and accepted that what was happening in Rwanda was a genocide, then that triggered not only a certain response in view of the morality, but also in terms of international law. And that response was not a desired response at the highest levels of France, Belgium, the United States, and the United Nations can only act when the leading members have the political will to act. We also know that Kofi Annan is not responsible for the relationship that existed between Boutros Boutros-Ghali and others with the government of Rwanda, and those others do include those three governments, the United States government being one of them.
Now, I remember hearing some of the officials, like Madeleine Albright, dealing with that issue of genocide and saying something like genocidal, perhaps genocidal tendencies or something like that, but being very clear, as you said, not to trigger international law provisions by not using that word. Do you think there were, do you think President Clinton dealt with that on his trip to Africa, or are you waiting for Clinton to respond to this as well?
Well, we understand that Secretary of State Madeleine Albright was the U.S. representative at the U.N. at that time. So she sat in those Security Council meetings. She knows what the United States knew and when it knew it. So having testimony from Secretary Albright is going to be critical for us to have an understanding of what happened and what went wrong in 1994. If never again truly means never again, then we've got to have the institutional changes to make sure that the United States is prepared to act in. We don't want there to be another genocide, but if there is another genocide anywhere in the world, the United States must be prepared to act. That means that we've got to change the way we do business so that we can respond and respond rapidly in the case of a genocide. So we have got to make sure that our institutions are prepared to handle that trigger of international law.
The article in The New Yorker, to say the least, is quite damning of a number of people, including Kofi Annan and the Clinton administration. It says, it was true that the Clinton administration had lost its appetite for peacekeeping operations after Somalia. In the wake of that debacle, the White House produced a document called Presidential Decision Directive 25, which amounted to a checklist of reasons to avoid involvement in U.S. peacekeeping in U.N. peacekeeping missions. It hardly mattered that no American troops were involved in Rwanda. When the genocide began, the administration's policy was that the U.N. should get out of Rwanda completely, and the original force of 2,500 men was reduced to an ineffectual squad of 270. Dallaire begged for reinforcements. His pleas were seconded by Boutros Ghali, but as the dead piled up in Rwanda, the United States successfully obstructed the Security Council from heeding their call. Are you going to call President Clinton or Secretary of State Madeleine Albright before your committee to testify?
Well, Senator Destex hand-delivered a letter to us. His testimony basically calls for the United States to do the same kind of investigation of the decision-making in 1994 that Belgium and France have undertaken. And I believe that that call is a worthwhile call, particularly in light of the fact that the State Department chose not to show up and participate in this mild hearing that we had scheduled on Tuesday. I do believe that Secretary Albright is going to be critical in learning just exactly what happened. And if it is not enough, it is not good enough for the President and Secretary Albright to go to Africa and say, I'm sorry, and then not come home and, one, put money into helping to rebuild that poor country, and, two, in not putting in place institutional changes that make good on their apology.
So are you going to be introducing legislation now?
We have already taken up the matter with the subcommittee chairman, and we have hand-delivered the letter to Congressman Gilman calling for a full investigation of what went wrong in Rwanda, in our Rwanda decision-making in 1994.
And do you think that you'll ever get a direct response from the United Nations, from the U.N. Secretary General Kofi Annan?
That's a very interesting question, because we called General Dallaire in Canada to request that he participate in our hearing that we held on Tuesday. And he was more than willing to participate in the hearing, but of course he had to have clearance from the United Nations, specifically from Kofi Annan. That clearance was denied. And so not only has General Dallaire not been able to participate in the Belgian inquiry, but he was not allowed to participate in the hearing that we scheduled. That, of course, went on the record. We put that information on the record. And, of course, now there are more people who will be calling for the appearance of Kofi Annan, Secretary of State Albright, as well as General Dallaire, to testify before the United States Congress. We will see where that all goes. It is very interesting that Kofi Annan is in Kigali on Wednesday and Thursday of this week, and perhaps we'll get more light shed on all of the decision-making that took place in 1994 that led to the slaughter of a million people in Rwanda. But let me give you this closing thought. If African-American Foreign Service officers in the State Department of the United States can't get a fair shake and had to file a lawsuit against Madeleine Albright in order to get a fair hearing on the correct use of their resources and their talents, how in the world can we expect U.S. foreign policy toward the African continent to be any better than the way they treat their own African-American citizens?
Georgia Congressmember Cynthia McKinney speaking to us from the Capitol. And that does it for today's show. If you'd like a copy of Democracy Now!, you can order a cassette from the Pacifica Archives by calling 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. By the way, tomorrow on Democracy Now!, a Mother's Day special. We'll be hearing a speech from Joan Borisenko, a psychologist talking about women's life cycles. Also, Lois Gibbs, many call the mother of the modern environmental movement, talking about Love Canal 20 years later. Democracy Now! Is produced by Hee Soo Koo and Jeremy Scahill. Our technical director, Errol Maitland. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!